Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get started. The topic of today's talk is the same topic of every July or August, which is hematologic emergencies. The summertime is the time, I think, to learn to deal with putting out fires and the most urgent issues, and then as the year goes on, a little more detailed or sophisticated problems. The things I'm going to deal with, if we break it up into hematologic and oncologic emergencies, in the second column, my pointer just went out. Do you have a pointer or no? Huh? All right, well, no pointer it is. So as you see in the second column, these are mostly oncologic emergencies. My colleague Dr. Alexis will be talking about those things, mostly related to solid tumors. There are some cytopenia or hyperleukocytosis you see at the bottom of the first column, which she will also deal with. So what I'm going to deal with is essentially the benign hematology emergencies that you would deal with. And those are going to focus on mainly four topics: sickle cell crisis, transfusion reactions, a TTP, and also DIC. We'll put that in the realm of hematologic emergencies. Huh? That's okay. I'm all right. So a few questions arise when talking about sickle cell disease. So which hemoglobin phenotypes are associated with acute chest syndrome? Is it just hemoglobin SS, or is it any sickle cell phenotype? Short answer is any phenotype. SC, SS, sickle beta thalassemia, these are all the sickle cell syndromes that can do that. Are there any laboratory or diagnostic tests that can screen for acute chest syndrome? I should have put what the abbreviation is. So ACS is acute chest syndrome, and that's the most life-threatening complication we're concerned about with sickle cell disease. So there is some stuff that can act as surrogate markers right now. And what's the best treatment modality for severe crisis, simple or an exchange transfusion? We'll go through some of that. So here I've listed the complications of sickle cell disease. Acute painful crisis is the one that you're probably most familiar with. You probably already had an admission for a sickler with a pain crisis. Acute chest syndrome is the one, like I said, that is most life-threatening, so the one that we're going to deal with today. And there's other complications as well, and these are all things that you should ask when taking a review of system or past medical history for the sickler. Have they had any renal complications, any stroke, osteonecrosis of the head, not really an emergency, but a complication. The sequestration of the liver and the spleen can be emergent issues as well, and also leg ulcers, not quite an urgency, and priapism, which can be another emergency also. So how does acute chest syndrome present? What are we looking for, right? When we look at the an EKG, we don't just look at it. We look for specific criteria, right, to diagnose an MI. You know that it's ST elevation, Q waves, T wave inversion, etc. So what are the criteria you're looking at here? And I sort of just stole these from the landmark article in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at acute chest syndrome in sickle cell patients. And this was out of the method section, their inclusion criteria. So you had to have a new infiltrate, and in half of those patients that was a pleural effusion. And one of the above symptoms, such as chest pain, cough, tachypnea, or wheezing, or a fever, or a drop in hemoglobin. Okay, so it sounds a lot like an pneumonia, right? I mean, you infiltrate, fever, coughing, sounds a lot like an pneumonia. So why is it not a pneumonia? And why does the hemoglobin drop? That could be one of two mechanisms, sequestration or acute hemolysis. So how do you differentiate acute chest syndrome versus pneumonia? Dr. Nagel, who was one of my mentors, was a great sickle cell researcher at Montefiore. He used to say there's no such thing as pneumonia in sickle cell patients. It's a different pathophysiology in sicklers. It's acute chest syndrome. I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but the point is that there are different things that cause the radiographic findings. So in acute chest syndrome, there's a low yield of bacterial diagnosis, even with bronchoscopy and lavage. It usually involves the basal lobes and is usually bilaterally. There's a dramatic effect to exchange, which obviously won't be the case with pneumonia. And what causes the infiltrate is actually the sickle cells are trapped in the alveoli wall, become deoxygenated and capable of exiting. So it's almost like they're being sequestered in the lung at that time. What are some of the other characteristics? It's the most common cause of death in sickle cell patients, so it's important to keep it in mind. Even though that it is a treatable complication, it's the second most common cause of hospitalization after uncomplicated vaso-occlusive pain crisis. It's preceded usually by a painful crisis. So somebody will have a pain crisis, they'll be discharged home and come back in a couple of days. And, you know, don't just think, well, they're, you know, drug seeking or whatever, that and we'll talk about the mechanism why that is, but the pain crisis can precede it, and sometimes it can come after it actually also. After the first acute chest syndrome, repeat episodes are common, and it can lead eventually to pulmonary hypertension, which we know is another cause of mortality in sickle cell patients. So what are the etiologies for sickle cell acute chest syndrome? Fat embolism is one of the most common. You have alveolar macrophages in 77% who had bronchoalveolar lavage. So they have their pain crisis. They have mini infarcts in their long bone. So they come in with a back or leg pain crisis. This embolizes and it causes acute chest syndrome. And that's why the pain crisis precedes the acute chest syndrome. Some of the infectious etiologies I've listed here. The viral, some atypical bacteria, so keep that in mind when covering them with antibiotics. But you know, the important thing is that 23% to 62% of the etiology is unknown, and that's also from that large trial that I had referenced before. They didn't know what the cause was in that one. I think it was about 30% or 40%, but the 23-62 is based on different references. So how does the fat emboli presentation differ from the other presentations? You have a lower mean oxygen saturation. You have a higher incidence of vaso-occlusive events with these patients with fat emboli. As I mentioned before, there's marrow necrosis and embolization of these necrotic cells. And it leads to the classic triad is confusion, also a rash, right? Skin changes, in addition to the shortness of breath. So those are things that you would look for. And it's frequently associated with sternal pain as well. So is there a reliable test that you can use to screen for acute chest syndrome? Anybody have an answer to that? Right now, there's no magical test, so it's still mostly clinical judgment. However, one marker that has been a good surrogate is serum phospholipase A2, which is a potent inflammatory mediator. It rises in patients and correlates with the severity of lung injury. It usually rises about 24 to 40 hours before the acute chest syndrome, so the timing of the testing is important. And transfusions, exchange or simple, can lower the plasma levels of serum phospholipase A2. And this is just a quote from the conclusion of this abstract in the blood, in which they thought that increased serum phospholipase A2 levels are capable of predicting impending acute chest syndrome and qualified as a screening tool. So can we just order it in Quadramed, serum phospholipase A2 level? No. However, there is a good surrogate for that, and also out of the blood journal is this, in which they correlated C-reactive protein. Yet another thing that C-reactive protein can correlate with. So this is a cheap test, can be done in-house, comes back the same day. So this is something that we can get. We are not routinely in the habit of doing this, but it's a simple test which probably should be done for these sicklers who were admitted and followed daily, just like we're following their CBC daily, and their oxygen saturation. So what's the treatment? The treatment is still going to be based on these clinical parameters. I'm not sure if you have a high CRP, if you're going to immediately exchange this person, but it may tip the balance one way or another if you have a mixed results of the clinical variables, which I mentioned before. So treatment is going to be the same treatment for sickler and pain crisis, analgesics. You are going to do broad-spectrum antibiotics, bronchodilators, incentive spirometry as well. And incentive spirometry is important because of the worsening of the hypoxia that can happen with splinting from the chest pain. They're not taking as deep breaths, and so you have a downward spiral of with deoxygenation of more sickling and more crisis after that. And you can use a simpler exchange. So who gets a simple transfusion and who gets an exchange transfusion. How do we differentiate that? Well, we have some parameters over here. One is when the oxygen saturation is low, but you know what? That's going to be for either one, simple or exchange. If the patient is confused, right, then they have fat emboli, then they may benefit more from exchange than a simple. And sternal pain, although that's a lot of patients, not so specific, but can also indicate a fat emboli. But to me, the most important variable in deciding a simple transfusion and an exchange transfusion is what is their baseline hemoglobin, right? So what should the baseline hemoglobin be for a patient with hemoglobin SS? Anybody have a guess on that? Ten's a little bit high. Yeah, it's usually in published studies it's about 8.5, 8.4 is what they do. 10 is for SC patients. So SC patients tend to run a little bit higher, okay? And the reason why that's important is that you don't want to over-transfuse somebody. You can actually potentiate or worsen the crisis for somebody if they have, they're running at their baseline hemoglobin, you give them a high volume of blood, and that could actually make things worse. If somebody is low, then that's simple, right? Their hemoglobin is 6 and their baseline is 8, then just give them 2 units, right? You don't have to think about it as much as with an exchange. But if they're at their normal baseline, then you need to do an exchange transfusion for those patients. And sometimes somebody who has had multiple transfusions, it'll be difficult to find cross-matched blood. They will develop antibodies and be alloimmunized to blood. All right, so in summary, patients with any of the sickle cell subtypes can develop acute chest syndrome. It's predominantly a clinical diagnosis, although we do have some markers right now. It's usually preceded by a vaso-occlusive crisis, and it sounds a lot like pneumonia. New pulmonary infiltrate accompanied by fever and chest pain and respiratory symptoms, right? So, you know, you're thinking pneumonia, but in a sickler also think acute chest syndrome. And what's not in there in that summary is also the hypoxemia. That's the other thing that we follow as well. Yes?
Can
it occur in sickle cell trait? That's actually one of the questions I got over the weekend. Somebody asked me that on rounds over the weekend. Can a sickle cell trait person get crisis? The answer to that is no. Sickle cell trait patients can sometimes get, under severe stress, can get some renal complications, can have some sickness, but usually not. More commonly what happens is someone is misdiagnosed as the trait and they actually have a sickle beta plus thalassemia. So they're a sickle thal and they're thought to be trait and they're told they were trait but they're actually sickle thalassemia. You just have to confirm, and the way we differentiate thalassemia or know that sickle thalassemia, the electrophoresis should report hemoglobin A2 levels. Some of the older ones here don't report that, and you have to get a separate A2 for that, and that tells you about beta thalassemia but not necessarily alpha thalassemia. All right, next topic in the hematologic emergencies is transfusion reactions. Something I fondly recall being called for as an intern myself, one of my first night calls. So what is the risk of a blood transfusion? And it's mostly infectious, but there's still possibilities of transfusion-related immunologic reactions, I should say. ABO incompatibility, 1 in 12,000 still, believe it or not. Acute lung injury, trolley, we'll show a case of that. Anaphylaxis, and also circulatory overload, which is more of a volume issue than an immunologic issue, for a total risk of 8 in 10,000. Now, this next slide is still one of my favorites every year. I haven't updated it in a while, but you know, a lot of patients, when you consent them, they will like to know what is the risk, and they're usually concerned about the infectious complications. So we see here HIV is actually about 1 in 2 million. Hep B and Hep C, I would think it's lower than that because we're testing the donors and we're testing the blood as well after it's collected. But my favorite is the last line. Being murdered in Washington, D.C., 1 in 2,155. So this was actually published in Transfusion Medicine. I hope nobody's offended if they're from Washington, D.C. It's effective for them that, you know, you have more of a chance of a traumatic death in another city. And I don't know what the stats are for the Bronx, but I know the North Bronx is better than the South Bronx. But anyway, so it's still relatively low risk. And anaphylaxis is in there in the middle at 1 in 125,000. So acute hemolytic reactions, you can break them up into three, major, minor, and interdonor. So the major ones are the ones where you have the antibody in the recipient plasma, which react against the donor red blood cells that have the corresponding antigen. A minor mismatch is when an antigen on a recipient red blood cell is cross-matched with a donor antibody, and this may be from a multiparous female donor that may have been exposed to different antigens. And then there's interdonor, which is the antibody in the donor plasma and the antigen in the donor red blood cells intermix. So what are the symptoms of transfusion reaction? Chest tightness, shortness of breath, chills, back pain is common as well, hypotension, and burning at the IV site. What do you do for it? Let's go through the other transfusion reactions first. IgA deficiency, more common than you would think, 1 in 515. There was actually a case I remember as a fellow with a patient who was getting probably an unnecessary platelet transfusion prior to a liver biopsy, because we know that patients with hypersplenism, that platelet transfusion doesn't do much for them. The patient had an anaphylactic reaction and died prior to that, so that was a cautionary tale. So it can cause anaphylaxis and death. Now, does that mean we should test for IgA deficiency in anybody who's about to get their first blood transfusion? It's not currently recommended based on those numbers, that probability. But it's just something to keep in mind. Most reactions are actually febrile reactions, and that can be from bacterial contamination, especially with platelets. That platelets are kept in at room temperature in a shaker. They're good for about 5 days. So if you get one on the tail end of those 5 days, they can be contaminated more so. But could also be immunologic, where secondary developing HLA antibodies to the contaminating donor leukocytes, although all the transfusions we give are usually leukocyte depleted, or there's at least a leukocyte filter in them. So what do you do with management? So this is what you're here for, right? So you're called in the middle of the night, and simple, you have to stop the transfusion first thing. You start the IV fluid to avoid hypotension, shock, and renal failure. If they're oliguric, as in the late phase, then you may need fluid restriction and electrolyte monitoring. But the most important thing is prevention. And I still can't believe that this is still the number, but it still is the number. The 50% are a result of clerical errors. And this is, I think, a board question every year, that what's the most common cause of transfusion reaction. And it's always clerical error. And it seems like that hasn't changed yet. So what investigations do you do? And usually you call the blood bank, and they'll do a lot of the stuff that's on the bag of blood, or the remaining bag of blood. But the things you should check for are basically your hemolysis workup. You want to check for total bilirubin LDH, with increase in hemolysis. Urine, you're looking for hemoglobinuria, when the free hemoglobin is greater than 25 milligrams per deciliter, and hemosiderin, which takes a little while to come back. That happens once the plasma hemoglobin is greater than 50 milligrams per deciliter. Serum haptoglobin goes down. Why is that? Because it binds to the free hemoglobin. And that's a very sensitive but not specific marker, right? So even after a routine blood transfusion, you may have a decline in your serum haptoglobin, but it's a good thing to check. Coombs testing, obviously, and blood typing as well. One other reaction I want to talk about is trolley. What is trolley? It's defined as a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, which is related to transfusion, usually plasma containing, but it could be from any blood products, right? There's a two-hit hypothesis for this. You have symptoms that include dyspnea, cough, fever. It happens fairly quickly after the transfusion, and you have bilateral pulmonary infiltrates that look a lot like CHF. Okay, risk factors to make things worse and differentiating are cardiac disease and also hematologic malignancies as well, and inflammatory conditions also. It has a 5 to 8% mortality. So here we have an image of somebody with trolley. So you see you have the bilateral infiltrate that looks like it's almost complete whiteout. It looks like CHF. And then you have the x-ray 24 hours later after the patient has been intubated. I think I see an ET tube in there in which it has cleared up. So it is reversible with the proper management. So if you suspect trolley, and the pulmonologists tend to get excited about this also, but if you do suspect it, you have to first thing rule out cardiogenic pulmonary edema, right? Because it's going to be opposite treatments, right? The mechanism of trolley is that you have a capillary leak, and usually this is immunologic mediated. You'll see actually neutrophils in the bronchial alveolar lavage. You'll have an antigenic or an antibody response to those neutrophils causing this capillary leak. So some of the testing that we'll do after the stuff to rule out CHF, and that may include a Swan-Ganz catheter or an echocardiogram, you notify the blood bank again, and you send the blood sample to the blood bank. And then it has to do a lot with HLA typing and cross-matching the neutrophil antigens of the patient along with the antibodies of the potential donors. They check female donors first because, as I mentioned before, multiparous donors tend to have more antibodies because of they are multiparous, and so they get exposure to the fetus or the baby's blood and develop an immunologic response to that. So treatment, you make the correct diagnosis, you give IV fluids as opposed to CHF, where you would actually diurese. You supplement with oxygen or mechanical ventilation, which tends to help. The positive pressure tends to relieve the capillary leak and the pulmonary edema. Diuretics are relatively contraindicated, and because it's an immunologic response, glucocorticoids may help also. So just in summary for transfusion reactions, maybe due to incompatibility, IgA deficiency, allergy, or bacterial contamination, major hemolytic transfusion reactions may progress to hypotension and shock, and prevention is the most important thing, and still clerocardials are one of the most common causes. Any questions so far about sickle cell or transfusion reactions before I go on to the next two topics? No? All right, TTP. What is TTP? And this definition has changed over the last 10 years. But thrombotic thrombocytopenia purpura is a syndrome of target organ dysfunction, which is caused by marked platelet aggregation in the microcirculation. So it's actually a hypercoagulable state, right? You have mini thrombi in the organs causing these symptoms. It's explained by an acquired or genetically absent van Willebrand factor cleaving protease, which results in unusually large van Willebrand factor. That's what the ULVWF stands for. Okay, and the plasma metalloprotease Adams T13, which stands for disintegrant and metalloprotease with thrombospondin type 1 motif 13. So say that fast three times. So that is the cleaving protease here, and it's actually something that was discovered by Han Musai over at Montefiore and first published in 1998, and this is from that article in the New England Journal of Medicine. So just a schema mechanism. So you have on the left a normal subject. You have the multimers of von Willebrand factor, which are cleaved by the protease, and therefore you have normal clotting and fibrinolysis. The patient on the right with TTP, you have an absent Adams T13 protease, and so you have the unusually large von Willebrand factor multimers, which promote clotting and platelet activation as well. So what are we looking for? What is the thing? This is what we get the hematology fellow up in the middle of the night for, right? To look at this slide. Because even though we have testing for the Adam T13, right, it still takes a week, right? You got to make your decision in the week to treat them. So we still have to come in and look at the smear. So what do we see over here that's notable in this?
Schistocytes.
Yes, schistocytes, right? So little helmet cells or red blood cell fragments. The arrow at the bottom is referring to a reticulocyte. You see the larger and slightly purplish hue of that cell. So that shows that there is hemolysis or a response, physiologic response to hemolysis with reticulopoiesis. And what is noticeably absent in this smear?
Platelets,
exactly, right? And it's important to look at the smear, right? I remember being called in the middle of the night as a fellow, and good thing I was moonlighting because it was actually a clotted specimen, so it wasn't TTP. It was just clotted platelets, and that's the other thing that we need to look at the smear for anybody with thrombocytopenia, make sure it's not a pseudothrombocytopenia. So that's the TTP slide, and I think this will be on your boards too. Not sure. I'll tell you in a few months as I'm recertifying eventually. So red cell fragmentation can be from more than one thing, though. So that's important to point out, too, right? Not all that is microangiopathic is TTP. So you have traumatic, right, from prosthetic heart valves or marsh hemoglobinuria, also known as runner's anemia. Infectious like coxsackie or malaria. And microangiopathic, and microangiopathic can be broken up into different things. You have vasculitic, right? So you could have lupus patients most commonly can have a microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. 2% of the time that can be TTP, but oftentimes it's just from the vasculitis. Malignant hypertension can mimic TTP as well. DIC, you could also have schistocytes on the smears there. And then the thrombotic microangiopathies, HUS, hemolytic uremic syndrome, eclampsia and HELLP syndrome, TTP, and cancer-associated HUS are some of the causes. So what are the treatment options for this? So this is something you should know, is plasma exchange. Plasma infusion is not a bad option as well. So how does plasma exchange and plasma infusion work? So plasma exchange is usually, if it's especially if it's an acquired or immunologic mediated deficiency in the metalloprotease, you are ferrescing off that immunologic component that is causing that. When you give the plasma, you're giving normal or cleaved vanrolone factor as well. So both have an effect. And the Canadian apheresis study in 1991 showed a survival advantage in giving plasma exchange versus plasma infusion. So that became the standard of care afterwards. The other important thing, which you should remember, and this has been an M&M case every couple of years, not here fortunately, is that you don't give a platelet transfusion, right? Why do you not give a platelet transfusion in a patient with TTP? The recorder can't hear you. This is going to be for every year. So the reason why you give it is that you promote further clotting. You're adding fuel to the fire with that. So by giving a platelet transfusion, you could actually cause a stroke or cause other end organ hypercoagulability. That being said, there's a couple of case reports with safely giving platelet transfusion, but without a randomized trial or a case series, I don't think that you can safely give it. And the general standard is to not give platelet transfusion. And that's important because when you call surgery to place that line, right, the reflex is, well, there's a patient with a platelet count of 5, I want to give a platelet transfusion. So this is always a discussion prior to the line placement, which needs to be placed rather urgently for this, and that this is it's contraindicated in this case. The patient is not at risk of bleeding, the patient is actually clotting everywhere, despite a platelet count of 5, okay? These other things are usually given for refractory cases, steroids, antiplatelet drugs, splenectomy, we don't do more. But rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody against CD20, used for lymphoma, also now being used for many immunologic disorders, including lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, and so that can help in refractory relapse patients. So as I mentioned before, the mechanism of apheresis is that it acts to supply the van Willebrand factor protease and also remove the inhibitor. The procedures are done daily until the platelet count and the LDH are normal. Then they're usually tapered off to every other or every third day. And this is when we're using that second week is when we start to get into a discussion is when can the patient go home? And I know length of stay is such an important issue here. But if you stop the patient too early, they will relapse. So it's very important to continue it, and sometimes they can continue as an outpatient, but usually they're going to be here at least 2 or 3 weeks. Venous access is an important issue. These are practical issues you're going to have to deal with in the middle of the night, and so you'd like a central line with at least a dual lumen. Femoral versus subclavian. Femoral increases thrombosis and infection, although it's easier to put and safer to put as far as bleeding complication than subclavian. This is actually a trial that was done and published in JAMA looking at this, and so they took 293 patients. They randomized them to undergo a central venous subclavian versus femoral, and then they went down and looked at the complications of that, and found that I think the results are on the next page. Yes, femoral group basically had more infections. The subclavian group, is it in this slide or the next slide, tended to have more bleeding complication. I think there was one pneumothorax as well. So you have to pick your risk, your competing risk. And so, but in general, it's felt that femoral is okay, but it just can't stay very long. And there is a concern for infection, which can complicate the interpretation of the CBC layer, because we know that bacteremia or sepsis can also lower your platelet count. You raising your hand or stretching?
Stretching.
Okay. All right. So what are the complications of plasmapheresis related to the central venous catheter? So in another study, 21 patients had complications, which two of them had deaths. One was hemorrhage from subclavian. The problem with subclavian is how you're going to put pressure on something like that. That's the difficulty there. And one had a pneumothorax. Minor complications include infections. And 28 patients, 39%, had no complications. This was one other smaller study. Sorry, I didn't put the reference at the bottom. Any questions about TTP? No? Okay, the last thing I'll talk about is DIC, and we know that it's a heterogeneous entity, because it's one of these things where you can have bleeding or you can have clotting, right? And one of the questions that sometimes comes up or has come up in morning report in the past, that there's a patient and who was presented as a TTP, and the question was, well, no platelet transfusion, but what if they're bleeding? So what if a TTP patient is bleeding? Do you transfuse platelets or not? The answer to that question is it's not TTP then, right? That means it's probably DIC, right? Because like as I mentioned before, there's lots of causes for microhemorrhagic hemolytic anemia, and it's not just a TTP, okay? And if they are bleeding, then you know what, it's probably okay to give platelets then. We know what DIC is. It's a dysregulation of thrombin formation or plasmin generation causing clotting or bleeding, and it can result in hemorrhage, thrombosis, or multi-organ system failure. Routine labs that we do to check this are CBC, PTPTT, fibrinogen, fibrin degradation products, or D-dimer. So what happens to fibrinogen in DIC? Does it go up or down? Goes down, yes. And what happens to the D-dimer and degradation products? Yeah, that goes up, right? So you have breakdown of fibrinogen, and the breakdown product is D-dimer, and so this will sometimes help differentiate for someone, say, with liver disease or hypofibrinogenemia or dysfibrinogenemia, or they'll have a low fibrinogen, but they'll have normal degradation products or D-dimers. So these are some of the tests that we do and just looking at the sensitivity and for that. Coags are not the most sensitive, but the D-dimer and degradation products are, and fibrinogen is sort of in the middle for that. There's other specialized tests which I've listed in the right-hand column, which are not immediately available or not available right away. We can get a factor 10A, right? That's what we use for monitoring fragment or Lovenox, low molecular weight heparin. Some of these other tests, these molecular markers or the paracoagulation assay, last time I checked with the SENDAT lab, is not something that that we can routinely get here or with Quest. And then other natural anticoagulant levels, protein C, protein S, and thrombin, we can get those tests in-house. So what are some of the causes for DIC? I just put this up to remind everybody, because we think of in medicine, we sort of have a tunnel vision that everything is sepsis causing DIC, right? It's always sepsis. So you go to the unit, everybody has that. But remember, we're a trauma center here too. And actually the most common cause for DIC is hypotension. For someone who's suffered a cardiac arrest can have this. Someone who's had a trauma can have this. Crush injuries or head injuries can do this, right? It releases a tissue factor when you have a brain injury. We are a regional bite center, so I had to put the toxins in there and the viper venom bites. And actually, I think 2 years ago when I gave this talk, there was a patient admitted for that with a snake bite. And then some of the drugs also on the right, L-asparaginase is a chemotherapy used for acute leukemia, which is confusing because acute leukemia in and of itself can cause a DIC, and actually I have at the top with the tumors the AML, the M3 variant. Now that's going to be on your boards every year, right? That's somebody who presents with acute promyelocytic leukemia, although it can be any of the acute leukemias, and they have DIC. So what is the magical treatment for that that can result in a remission and a cure in over 90%. It's actually one of the better prognosis, acute leukemias, if you get to it on time. It can kill you in days, but if you treat it on time, and treat the DIC on time. No? Nobody's heard of this? Board question. What's that? Yeah, all transretinoic acid. Right, Atra. So Atra is an oral therapy that you can use for that. So that's, I think, two board questions you get from this talk or on your in-service exam. Obstetrical complications also. We have a high-risk OB over here, and that's something else that can cause DIC. Can sort of a continuum between HELLP syndrome and DIC. So what's the pathogenesis? You have depletion of hemostatic factors that can cause a hypofibrinogenemia and a defibrination syndrome. This happens with the snake bites and the placental abruptions. You have a depletion of inhibitors, which give you a potential for bleeding. You have a depletion of the alpha-2 antiplasmin, or potential for thrombosis if you have a depletion of the antithrombin protein C or protein S as well. So there's heterogeneous triggers for DIC. Other things that can do it, as I mentioned before, tissue injury by releasing tissue thromboplastin, so brain injuries being common, placental abruption can do that. Cytokines like in septicemia, direct activation of factor X, like in adenocarcinoma, factor 10, sorry, not factor X. Prothrombin activation, so I'm getting more specific with which snake venom it is. I don't think that will be on your boards. Procoagulant platelet membranes like HIT, so HIT can eventually cause DIC if it becomes bad enough, and endothelial injury or activation as well. Other localized causes are abdominal aortic aneurysms and giant hemangioma syndrome. So what is the treatment? So we have some special situations. Usually the treatment is treat the underlying cause, right? That's what we've been taught. For placental abruption, it's going to be obstetrical intervention and possibly cryoprecipitate. We usually guide our cryoprecipitate infusion based on what the fibrinogen level is, right? And we just had actually a case this week. I don't know if medicine consult was involved in that, but we had a very interesting case with patient with, I don't think the patient had DIC, but was treated with multiple units of FFP, and then they gave the patient cryoprecipitate. Anybody know what the difference is between factors that are in FFP and cryoprecipitate? So cryoprecipitate is what rises to the top basically when you thaw out the FFP, right? And that's usually for East off, and it'll take one bag of cryoprecipitate, usually gotten from 10 units of FFP, and it has factor 8, factor 9, fibrinogen, I think factor 11 or 13 are on there, and Van Willebrand factor too, because that's bound to factor 8. So somebody with hemophilia or DIC with low fibrinogen, cryoprecipitate may be a better choice than giving FFP, because FFP, it's a big volume, and not everybody can handle 8 units of FFP. Prostate CA is another one, one of the adenocarcinomas that can cause DIC. It's a more of a chronic DIC picture. You could also give cryoprecipitate, but also sometimes you have to you give heparin for a chronic DIC. And then amicar, aminocaproic acid, is something that we give as an oral rinse for patients with von Willebrand's disease, but it could also be given IV for patients with various causes for bleeding. And then acute promyelocytic leukemia, and we talked about that example already. For the prothrombotic patients, adenocarcinoma, Trousseau syndrome, you avoid warfarin, right? That can potentiate things and make it worse, right? The warfarin skin necrosis that can happen with those patients with protein C depletion already. So we give heparin for those patients. Septicemia with acrogangrene, we give vitamin K, heparin FFP. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the recombinant activated protein C, or drug-trigogan. Has anybody used that in the ICU? No? Yeah, I've only seen two patients since it was approved using it with a 50% efficacy rate. HIT usually is a DIC picture, and for these patients we like to use the heparin alternative, such as loperidone, argatroban. Loperidone if they have kidney disease, because that's kidney, if they have liver disease, because that's kidney metabolized, and argatroban is liver metabolized, so you base it based on the kidney or liver function, and danaproid. So just one comment about this study for the recombinant human activated protein C. This was a randomized trial, once again, in the New England Journal. It's 1,960 patients with known infection, and they had a scoring system to stratify these patients with the DIC, and they had to have greater than 3 signs of systemic inflammation and sepsis-induced dysfunction to get into the study. They were given the placebo or the recombinant protein C, and the results of the study showed that it showed a relative risk reduction of death of 19.4% for an absolute reduction of 6%. There was slightly more bleeding, absolute number only 1.5%, but I guess if you do the relative numbers, it's a significant enough number that you have to use it with caution. So, in summary, for the entire talk, we just... the things I want you to take home for this. Sickle cell disease, we know that red blood cell exchange is the treatment that can treat a lot of these different things, from priapism to acute chest syndrome, so it can be life-saving in these patients, and so that's something that we want to consider for someone that either had an acute chest syndrome before or has the symptoms that I mentioned previously with hypoxemia. Transfusion reactions, they can be from many different causes, incompatibility, immunologic, or rarely bacterial. And then there's trolley, in which you just really have to differentiate between CHF and or not, because it's going to be opposite treatments. TTP, the take-home messages for that is that plasmapheresis is a treatment of choice. It's you have to differentiate from other causes of microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, and don't give a platelet transfusion because it can worsen the platelet aggregation by doing that. And finally, DIC, many causes, you treat the underlying cause, and occasionally the activated protein C concentrate can be used for those patients. And that's it. Any questions? Thank you for coming. So you want to save this or something?
Yes.
Yeah, but let me just change that once.
Should we stop the recording?
We should.
Just click on the slide.